This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Standing now on the stark economic frontier of the 21st century, the stunning optimism of the last decade seems like a dim memory. In the heady days of the 90s, technology sizzled, global trade blossomed, and the new economy claimed it would rewrite the rules of capitalism. Now those optimistic notions have been replaced with the more prosaic struggle to cope with corporate scandals, shaky infrastructure, and a jobless recovery. What happened? In his new book, The Roaring 90s, Nobel Prize-winning economist Joseph Stiglitz tells the story of this prosperous decade from his vantage point as the head of the President Clinton's Council of Economic Advisers. While Americans rushed to catch the economic tidal wave, behind the scenes, powerful forces fought to define the source of this sudden prosperity and the necessary policies to prolong it. The book tells the story of some of the battles that were lost and the consequences. Did you get on the economic roller coaster in the 90s? Where did it let you off, and what have you learned? Do you have questions about the financial changes of the last decade or what their legacy will be for the future? Join the conversation. Our number here in Washington, 800-989-8255. The email address, totn@npr.org. And joining us now from our New York bureau is economist Joseph Stiglitz to talk about the boom and bust 90s and the lessons we should have learned. Welcome to the show, Mr. Stiglitz.
Thank you for being here.
First of all, the Clinton administration got a lot of credit for the boom times in the 90s, but in your book you say there was a lot of luck involved in that credit. How so?
Well, partly it was the luck of a number of technologies maturing. We had been investing in technology. Some of the basic innovations had occurred years, decades before, and all that came together. That technology boom, internet, for instance, and that was in many ways the driving engine.
When President Clinton came into office in 1993, he made deficit reduction the focus of his economic policy, which, as you explain in your book, was really contrary to established wisdom, economic wisdom at the time.
That's right. And one of the reasons for motivations behind my writing the book was that I wanted to debunk that particular myth. Many people had come away with the view that what had led to the recovery was deficit reduction. And if that was the case, it had profound implications for what we taught in every economic course around the world. The standard prescriptions for the last 70 years is that when the economy faces an economic downturn, you need to stimulate the economy, you need to cut taxes, increase expenditures. In fact, you have to live with a bigger deficit temporarily. In the long run, deficits are a problem. But in the short run, for an economy facing an economic downturn, deficits are the right medicine.
And so how exactly did the deficit reduction at that time help sort of fuel the boom or the bubble, let's say, of the 90s?
Well, let me first explain what was wrong with the logic that was used. We said that deficit reduction would allow lower interest rates, and lower interest rates would stimulate investment, and that would lead to recovery. But there is nothing in economic theory or experience that says that the Fed can only lower interest rates when there is a low level of deficits. In fact, it can even stimulate the economy even better when there's a higher level of deficit. So that explanation just doesn't carry very much water. What happened, of course, was that the deficit reduction did lower interest rates, and many of the banks in the United States had at the time high levels of long-term government bonds. It was a risky position, a result of some faulty decisions about the regulatory structure, where they were effectively encouraged to hold these long-term bonds. The result of that was that when the interest rates came down, the value of the long-term bonds increased, and that recapitalized our banking system, and that led to more lending. But it was not the standard explanation at all. And the important lesson is that if you follow that advice, the prescription that we followed in the early 90s, you'll wind up in a disaster. Deficit reduction was used in Argentina, in East Asia, in country after country, and it led to the kinds of consequences that economists had forecast for 70 years. Each case, the downturn turned into a recession, recession into a depression. So it is not, in general, a good medicine.
Well, some of what went right actually had its root in the savings and loans crisis of the 1980s. Can you explain that?
Well, both what went right and what went wrong has to do with way back then. What happened in the savings and loan crisis was that many of our banks, when the interest rates went way up, became effectively bankrupt. They weren't all bankrupt, but their net worth was negative, and there was an attempt to prolong their life. Some people called them zombie banks, but in the end, they had to be bailed out, massive bailout. In the aftermath of that bailout, regulations got tighter. One of the consequences of that is that lending became it was more difficult to borrow. But the other side of that was that the Fed allowed banks to treat long-term government bonds as if they were safe. Now, of course, the long-term government bonds don't face any risk of a default. The federal government's not going to default. But long-term government bonds are risky because when interest rates change, if interest rates go up, the value of those bonds go down. So they were allowed to treat those bonds as if they were safe. They were allowed to treat the high income, the high interest payments they got, as if it were ordinary income, not setting aside any reserves for the risk that the price of those bonds might fall. And so they were booking high income, and yet they were in a very precarious position. If the interest rates had risen, the bonds would have fallen, and we would have had to have another bailout. But because interest rates fell, the value of those bonds increased, and that was what underlay the recovery of the United States in 1993-94.
Mm-hmm. And you say in the book that the fundamental problem with the 90s, though, was that some of the longstanding checks and balances in the business world were upset by the sudden dominance of the financial sector, things like the stock market and the economy. Can you explain that?
Well, any economy requires a set of regulations. Economy is like a game. You need rules and referees. And you need to have an appropriate framework for people to interact. What happened is that in the 90s, we adopted the deregulation mantra, stripping away regulation. Yes, we have many regulations that needed to be changed. Many of the regulations were adopted 50, 60 years ago. And so there was absolutely no doubt that there needed to be major reforms. But the mantra should not have been deregulation. It should have been, let's find the right regulatory structures for the problems of today. So, for instance, as one example, we have firms that found new ways of engaging in accounting tricks to make it more difficult to see what was really going on. We needed to have stricter regulations affecting the accountants. In fact, there was an initiative to do that, but it was not allowed to go forward. Another example is that we had, for a long time, had a separation between commercial and investment banks. Separation that was intended to provide, to reduce the risk of conflicts of interest. Financial community didn't like it. They saw new opportunities by bringing those two things together. They said, oh, trust us. Don't worry about these conflicts of interest. You just trust us. And then they said, we'll create Chinese walls so there won't be any conflicts of interest. And the natural question is, well, if you're going to create Chinese walls, why bring them together? If they can't talk to each other, what's the synergies you're going to get? They never answered that question. They went ahead. They merged. And then we just added one more set of problems of conflicts of interest to the ones that we already had involving CEO compensation, accounting, the analyst providing bad information, a whole set of conflicts of interest, which not only, in my mind, generate a whole set of inequities. Effectively, many shareholders having their wealth stolen by CEOs and by investment banks. But even more concerned to me as an economist is the fact that the information that was reflected in the prices of shares was distorted. And if prices are based on distorted information, they can't do what they're supposed to do, which is to guide resources to where they're most productive. And so as a result of that, we had a massive wastage of resources, and including massive investment leading to excess capacity, problems which we are now having to deal with.
We're talking with economist Joseph Stiglitz about his new book, The Roaring Nineties. If you'd like to join our discussion, the number is 800-989-TALK, and you can send us an email at totn@npr.org. Let's take a call from Paul in St. Louis. Hi, Paul.
Hi. My question kind of stems out of my experience. I'm a journalist, and I got sucked into the dot-com world, then got spit out unemployed in the spring of 2001 when the company I worked for failed. Personally, I looked at it, and there were no regular journalism jobs available in my local market, so I started a dot-com myself. It's been 2.5 hard years. I've got the second mortgage. The credit cards are maxed, but the company's starting to do well. I want to know, do you think that the dot-bomb has spurred a lot of other people and that we're going to see a wave of startups starting to succeed in the next few years?
Well, I think that there was something real about the new economy. There were, as I said before, the real changes in our technology. The problem was that it was hyped. It was exaggerated. Some people thought the new economy represented the end of the business cycle. Well, we now know that that's not true. We've lost 2.8 million jobs in the last 3 years. I do think that when the economy does recover and every downturn eventually comes to an end, we will go back to some of the technologies that we put aside, and I think we'll discover that some of them were good ideas and just came at the wrong time. It's very hard to start a new business when the economy is going into a downturn, into a recession. And on the other hand, I think we'll hopefully be a little bit more circumspect than we were in the past. There were some really quite crazy ideas there that were able to get enormous amounts of money. I think we'll be a little bit more careful when we look at some of these dotty ideas.
Thanks for your call. You do, in your book, keep saying that one of the fatal flaws of the new economy was the extreme short-sightedness. How could so many people have lost sight of the consequences of their actions or what might happen as a result of some of their actions?
Well, I think a lot of people were caught up in what the chairman of the Fed, Alan Greenspan, referred to as this irrational exuberance. They wanted there to be a boom. They were making money out of it, and it was in everybody's incentive to sort of hype it up. The analysts made money by selling shares and by getting more business for their investment houses. The CEOs were making huge amounts of money out of their stock options. It wasn't as if they were necessarily making their firm do better than other firms. Everybody was doing well. And so there was, in a sense, a coincidence of the interest of an awful lot of people to keep this bubble going. And then, of course, there were some, I think, major policy mistakes. For instance, we cut capital gains taxes, and that was simply fed the frenzy.
I'm going to ask you more about those policy mistakes when we return from a short break. We're talking with economist Joseph Stiglitz. If you'd like to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
Thank you.
This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary, in for Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking with Joseph Stiglitz about his new book, The Roaring '90s, A New History of the World's Most Prosperous Decade. Are you still trying to understand the ups and downs of that decade and how it relates to our current economic situation? You're invited to join the discussion. Give us a call at 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. Mr. Stiglitz, right before the break, we were talking about, you were saying that there are a number of policy mistakes, you think, that were made in the 90s. Maybe you can expand on that a little bit more.
Well, the one I was talking about just as the break came was that we cut capital gains taxes. We effectively were encouraging people to speculate on the stock market, and of course they did. It was really feeding the frenzy. And what was ironical was, if you look over the what happened in the two tax changes, one in 93 and one in 97, was that what we had done was we had increased taxes on upper middle income individuals who were working for a living and lowered those who were speculating for a living. And it didn't make any sense in terms of our basic values.
A part of your book, or a lot of your book actually, deals with some of the battles that the Council of Economic Advisers, which you were on, fought with other interests, the Treasury Department, lobbyists, congressmen, even the Fed. It seems like the Council lost a lot of those battles. What was the most crucial one, would you say, or the most important one in terms of the long-lasting effect or the effects that we're feeling now economically, the one that you would have really liked to have won?
Oh, there were several. I should say that we won a lot of battles, but of course you always regret the ones that you fought hard for and yet lost. I suppose three that I would mention just very briefly. One is we fought for a more balanced form of globalization. This was an era where the end of the Cold War meant that we needed to create a new global order without communism, a fairer global order, and we didn't have a vision, and instead we really let commercial and financial interests to a large extent dictate what we did. And the result of it is that some of the problems we've seen in the international arena of trade and the failure of the trade negotiations in Cancun. A second example was we fought for accounting reform. We argued that the way stock options were being reported was not providing shareholders with the information that they needed. And the Financial Accounting Standards Board said that.
And this was before Enron, I'm presuming.
It was 93, 94.
Right.
And at the time, there were, you know, not many people realized how important these accounting issues were. We thought they were important. I had done my basic theoretical work in the economics of information, and I knew that if markets didn't have good information, they wouldn't be able to function the way they're supposed to function. Even worse, I knew that if the stock options could give the CEOs an incentive to provide the wrong kind of information, they could make more money by hyping their stock than by doing some real investment. So we thought that was something that really needed to be taken care of. But unfortunately, those who were doing so well under the system didn't want to change. They gave absolutely the wrong argument. They said, well, you know, if people only knew what was going on, share prices would fall. My view was that's exactly an argument why we need to change things. If they knew, their judgment was the value of these shares were lower, we should take out the air now rather than waiting for several years and having the kind of problem that we are today confronting.
All right,
it's interesting. Arthur Levitt, who was the head of the Securities and Exchange Commission, who's ultimately had the responsibility, views this as one of his major, probably the major mistake in his career, that he did not push this issue harder. He was on the same side that we were on this, but the financial markets and the accountants just were not interested in these changes.
All right, let's take a call now from Jim in Spencer, Iowa. Hi, Jim.
Oh, hi. Joseph, I appreciate you being on the show today. I have a question about the way that generational investment seems to be working. As a member of the baby boom generation, it seems to me that the people who are at the head of the pack tend to do a lot better than those that are at the tail end of the pack. A lot of educational expenses, home investment, different types of investment in the stock market seem to benefit the people that are continually leading the pack and at the expense of those at the tail end of the pack. Is that something that you think there's any credibility to?
Well, I do think that there we have to be sensitive about what we sometimes call intergenerational equity, fairness across generations. And that's one of my concerns right now, and one of the real arguments for deficit reduction, that future generations are going to pay the price for the deficits that we are now accumulating. Somebody in the future is going to have to pay the price, and it will be our children. Or it will be the people that come in at the end of the baby boom when our Social Security system and our Medicare system do not have the funds that they need. And that's one of my strong criticisms in the book of the kinds of economic policies that President Bush has been pursuing in the last 3 years.
All right. Thanks so much for your call, Jim. We'll take another call now from Jason. He's in Boise, Idaho. Hi, Jason.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question is, right before the dot-com boom, I was turning 30. I had five extra grand to put away for my kids. And foolishly, I went online and tried to do it myself and dumped it all into one particular stock. It was Palm. And overnight, in what was called after-hours trading, it dropped about 75% in share price. And I woke up and realized this when I checked my computer. My question to you is, how... If for starters, is that one of the sort of nets that Enron worked within, sort of a complicated web that people like me didn't understand? Is that sort of indicative of that style of behind-the-scenes stuff, this after-hours trading business? But also, how for future economic situations, how have people like me who are now unwilling to sort of go online and do it ourselves, how do we affect the economy now by standing back like that?
Thanks. That's a good question, Jason.
Well, in fact, there were a large number of, you might call it nefarious ways by which the informed, the investment banks, the analysts, effectively stole money from ordinary investors like you. They did it in a whole variety of ways that I try to describe in ordinary English in my book. For instance, the analysts were touting stocks from which the investment banks were making money from the company that were issuing those stocks, while secretly they were saying that these were nothing but dogs. More recently, after my book was already in print, there have been new disclosures of bad behavior on the part of mutual funds who have been engaged in these kind of after-hours deals that may have affected you. I don't know about whether they were actually involved in your particular case. I think there are a couple of lessons that emerge from this. The first is one has to urge Congress and the government to pass rules. As I say, every game requires rules and referees. Soccer, if you don't have rules and referees. Baseball, if you don't have rules and referees, it'll be chaos. And the market is the same way. And what we've seen, the abuses that have occurred in accounting and finance about CEO executives, and those have to be addressed. There's no simple formula for addressing them, but clearly we need to do better than we did in the 90s. The second thing is you need to diversify your portfolio. Putting all your money and all your eggs in one basket is a very risky strategy, and there's some very good honest mutual funds out there that you can turn to that are not engaged in these kinds of practices.
You say in the book that risk became a way of life in the 90s. How's that coming back to haunt us now?
Well, in several respects, you can look at the kinds of risk that various institutions undertook. For instance, let me just mention one. Many of the companies finance their retirement accounts by putting their money in stock, and hoping that the rates of return on stock would be 9-10% kinds of returns that had been prevailed in the past. Of course, that was unrealistic. There have been short periods of these kinds of returns, but clearly not in the long run. And so what happened is that with the bursting of the technology bubble, the stock market bubble, many of the major companies in the United States today have underfunded pension funds, and amounting to literally $200-400 billion. There either will be a bailout, or some retirees are going to have to suffer. So that's an example where we in effect gambled, and now people today are somebody. Taxpayers or people going into retirement are going to have to pay the price.
All right, let's take a call now from Ernie. He's in Stuart, Iowa. Hi, Ernie.
Hello. I'd like to just ask Mr. Stiglitz, he seems to be emphasizing the importance of tax cuts and their contribution to the deficit. What about spending increases? I mean, certainly the Congress and the President have indulged heavily in spending, and that certainly has contributed to the deficit that we have. And as an economist, don't you feel a bit guilty about criticizing the tax cuts, since economists probably benefit from government spending, heavy government spending?
Well, unfortunately, most of the increases in spending have been associated with the military. Those are areas that we may not have had much choice over, though it is a question of some debate. The real concern that I have is that we are, in fact, underinvesting in things that will lead to long-term economic growth. I said before that the underlying source of the U.S. economy strength in the 90s was technology and innovations like the Internet. And the problem is those rest on basic science, R&D, that is supported by the federal government. Without the federal government expenditures, we would not have had the Internet, which has transformed every aspect of our economy today.
Okay, thanks so much for your call.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah. In your book, you devote a whole chapter to the Federal Reserve Board, particularly its chairman, Alan Greenspan. You think his role was overplayed? Why do you think his role was overplayed in the reporting on the boom of the 90s?
Well, there are a couple of things of concern. The first I already mentioned was that in fact, lowering interest rates could have occurred without the deficit reduction. His stance that it could only lower the interest rates if there was deficit reduction was not based on any economic theory. There was really a political agenda there that I think became finally clear in the spring of 2001 when he supported Bush's tax cuts. And these were tax cuts that were not designed to stimulate the economy and provided very little stimulus for the economy. They were really setting us up for some very, very long-run problems, of which he should have been aware, because he served as chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, and he knew how fragile some of these forecasts were. The second point I criticize is that he was aware that there was a potential of a bubble. He even invented the word irrational exuberance, which really helped us understand what was going on. But then he, after giving a speech in which he tried to talk the market down and it paid very little attention to it, he ignored it and began to talk the market up. He began to talk about the new era, the new technology. He didn't use the instruments that were at his disposal, for instance, increasing margin requirements that would have allowed us to take a little air out of the bubble, to deflate it gradually, rather than having the kind of burst that we eventually had that has led to the kind of difficulties that we've had now for over 2.5 years and with a loss of jobs of more than 2.8 million.
Joseph Stiglitz is the author of the new book, The Roaring 90s, and you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Let's take a call from Dave, and he is in Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Dave.
Hello.
Hello, go ahead.
Good. Thank you. Great show. My question is, now investor confidence is so critical to these markets. We have let the investors are no longer confident in either the venture capital market or the initial public offering market. Given that, they've shut down. How do we reestablish them? As in an entrepreneurial economy and technology economy, eventually we have to reestablish these markets. I'd love to hear what the professor has to say.
All right, thank you. Thanks.
I agree very much, and I think that is why the Bush administration should have acted earlier, should have responded more forcefully than it did. Eventually, when public pressure was so great, the Sarbanes-Oxley bill was passed, but even it did not fully address all the problems that keep coming out to light. The problem of the New York Stock Exchange, the problem now in the mutual funds, the after trading, hours trading. I think one of the things that has to be done is the major industries, the accountants, the financial community, the stock exchange, have to say, you know, we need stronger regulations, and we need really to have a new moral commitment that we are serving our investors. Unfortunately, what just happened in the New York Stock Exchange showed that many people didn't think anything was wrong. They hadn't learned the lessons of what had gone before. And I think until they learn those lessons, and I hope my book is a contribution to that, I think there will be this lack of confidence, which is going to impede our recovery.
Why is it that nobody really recognized that what we were experiencing in the 90s was a bubble, or did people realize it and just ignore it?
Yes, they did recognize it. Even Alan Greenspan talked about irrational exuberance. But they so much wanted to be a player in this bubble. They were so many people were making so much money that there were so many incentives to keep it going that we just threw caution to the winds.
All right. Well, thanks so much for being with us today, Mr. Stiglitz.
Thank you.
Joseph Stiglitz is a Nobel Prize winning economist, and he's the author of the new book, The Roaring 90s. When we come back from the break, from economics to etouffee, the heartbreak, glory, and big money on America's competitive cooking circuit. I'm Lynn Neary. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.